Ladies and gentlemen, as well as kids of all ages, welcome to Season 1, Episode 7 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming! In this episode, we look at gaming with significant others. We take a look at Hexographer. And finally, we have an interview with Micah from Obsidian Portal. Jeff, and my happy little co-host here is Pineapple. And along with us is our normal co-hosts of Mark and Zach. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad.
So, yeah, someone's happy. And for those listening, if you hear a screech or two, well, Pineapple was a little lonely when I was doing these podcasts, so he decided he needed to join us. So if you hear happy little noises, which is what he's making now, they're not that loud. So why don't we just kick it off and get right to it, shall we?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
Hurry, hurry, hurry! Step right up, folks, and let us dazzle you with some RPG news! All right, well, it's been quite a week with news-wise. A little slow. But the big one, I guess, for you, Zach, is Palladium Games. They had some news.
Yeah, Palladium Books. They had a temporary layoff. I actually, on my site, over at RPG Blog, too, I'd received some confirmation of it before it was announced. And basically, you had two employees who were at least temporarily kind of laid off. And the interesting thing to me was that Kevin Zambito, when he replied to it, said, you know, that this is something that they've done before, you know, to kind of get through those thin spots, you know, have an employee be laid off temporarily, go on unemployment for that time and come back, you know. So to me, it's more interesting as just a way that, you know, what a mid-sized gaming company's got to do to survive. You know, in the not so friendly economic times we live in. So, Jason Marker, who has been really doing some great things for the Robotech line there, is currently, I think, seeking other options. And Wayne Smith, who's the longtime Rifter editor and general utility infielder there at Palladium, is they expect him back in a few weeks, 6 to 8 weeks, I believe. So. Let's certainly hope for the best with that.
All right. Well, that's not too bad. I guess the next big news is I hate calling it news. Hey, someone's happy.
Pineapple doesn't.
See, he doesn't like this news either. it unfortunately involves Goodman Games, who, you know, I have a product or two from them. And it was kind of weird. It was GameCrier was, I guess, not the instigator, I guess. It's more along the lines of the recipient of these these nasty messages. GameCrier posted a review of a Goodman Games product, and apparently they didn't. Someone at Goodman Games did not like the review.
Well, not just someone; it was Joseph Goodman himself.
Well, I wasn't gonna go there because the fact that it got retweeted everywhere, I would have never known about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think that's true for a lot of people. The and the review itself, Madison London Town, over on GameCrier. Really, I've seen a lot more acidic reviews than this one. You know, it definitely takes to task the product for not being geographically or culturally accurate as far as its portrayal of England. Which I'm sure a lot of our British friends have problems when we write that, and I'm sure that we probably have problems when they write some products based in America. You know, it just kind of is. But you're dealing with a module here for Call of Cthulhu, and, you know, that sort of accuracy is important to some people. I think it's a valid point. And basically, in the comments of that is where Mr. Goodman really kind of just teed off attacking the reviewer in review without really refuting any of the points. So
yeah,
yeah.
That not, was not their not finest a hour. Moment.
Yeah, well, in other Goodman news, Yeah, Goodman. I don't know how to say that without kind of tripping over my tongue today. I guess their issue two of Level Up is being sold directly in stores for $2, but if you actually buy it from Goodman Games directly or in PDF format, it's $4. And their explanation is it's a way to drive the people back to the gaming stores.
That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah. I was just going to be quiet and no one asked my opinion on that one.
I mean, people aren't going to be more likely to buy it in stores because they can get it for more expensive somewhere else. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I was scratching my head at that one. I don't quite get that one either. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, however, it would be like Wizards taking the Player's Handbook and saying, "Well, you can buy it in the stores for $40, but we're going to sell it for $80 on our website, and that's going to at least double our sales."
Well, I mean, he was trying to do something to try to tell people, like, "Hey, let's get people to go to the game store." Honestly, I hate to tell him something. If buying it online for $4, if it's good, I have no idea. You know, it's $2 more than the in-store price. I'm sorry. I think I saved $2 in gas by not doing that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a wash.
It's a nice gesture, I guess, if for friendly local gaming stores and whatnot. But you know,
Yeah, the effectiveness, not something I'm thinking is going to happen. Yeah. However, the guys for Hackmaster, their Hackmaster Basic is almost sold out. At least that's what they claim. I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I've heard they just have a few copies left, so still at the $20 price point. So,
not too bad.
Pretty neat game.
Yeah. And then, let's see. We have a miniature contest. If you want to design your own, I guess, I think it's supposed to be original miniature for Mythmere Games. They got something for you there.
We'll have the link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. I thought that was. However, people, there is no monetary prize. There is actually pretty much no prize, just the notoriety that it gives you. But still, hey, that's pretty
cool. Still,
that's still pretty cool. And finally, on an old school note, the old school PDF sampler has been released, and it contains material from Brave Halfling Publishing, Expeditious Retreat Press, Goblinoid Games, and Laments of the Framed Princess. And we have links in the show notes to that particular product.
Excellent.
So,
Mark, you also had the beverage news.
The beverage news.
This has been going around Twitter quite a bit because people are both... Some people are amused and some people, for some reason, are shocked and appalled by it. But Jones Soda is coming out with special Dungeons & Dragons spellcasting soda. That's a limited edition. They got looks like 5 different flavors. Potion of Healing, Sneak Attack, what's that one down there? Bigby's Crushing Thirst Destroyer.
That's clever.
Dwarven Drought,
Eldritch Blast.
And then I think there was also, it's not showing up here on their website, but wasn't there an Illithid one as well? Or something about it, like Illithid Brain Juice or something like that. Yeah, Illithid Brain Juice is what it's called. So, and all it is just soda with different labeling on it. But World of Warcraft has done the exact same thing with the Mountain Dew cans that they're selling right now. So,
I like that the Illithid Brain Juice is purple. I don't know, it just fits for some reason. It kind of looks, at least on here it does. Actually, no, on here it's brown. I don't know. But it's cute. I don't know why people would be irritated about it, but I guess
I'd buy it for my group just, you know, to try it out.
Just for the heck of it, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
I just think it's just at least, you know what, actually, it's silly, but not as silly as the shoe contest.
This is the right direction from the shoes. You know, this is something, I mean, I don't really have a problem with the shoes, I guess. It's just kind of like, well, I don't You know, that was just kind of a very strange. It's like designing a D&D vacuum to me or something.
Well, like, I mean, as much as this soda is a little silly, at least, you know, let's face it. Last time I checked, most gamers drink soda on lots of it. So this is kind of silly. And no, I'm probably not going to buy any. But at least it's, I guess to my mind, it's a little more palatable than some strange shoe contest. So I'm going to leave it at that.
Maybe they should do, like, for the limited edition at Gen Con, do like a D&D soap. And that would kind of take care of the gamer stink and, you know, indulge our sense for weird memorabilia all at the same time. So,
yeah, there you go.
Just a thought.
Or deodorant. One of the soap or deodorant.
Yeah, I mean, look, they can do a whole hygiene line, I think. It would be a bad idea.
So, and finally, on that, for you listening to this, if you're listening to this now, you may have just missed Worldwide D&D Game Day, because it happens on September 19th, which is, as we record it, tomorrow. And also, for those who don't know it, September 19th has another significance. Do you guys know what that is?
International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Yes, it is.
People are calling Saturday International Talk Like a D&D Pirate Day.
Yeah.
Game Day 2009 or something like that. They've come up with a long, complicated nickname for it.
Yeah, I thought that was really funny. I was looking at a couple of different things today. I'm like, Game Day, September 19th. And I was like, then I saw another note, Pirate Day, September 19th. It's like, okay, there we go. Well, I think that finishes up for what we got going here, don't we?
Just one more.
You do got one more.
Yeah, to toot my own horn.
Oh, yeah. Toot away.
We have...
There's your horn Dice, for you.
Yep, there it is. DiceMonkey.net is going to be coming up. It should be up the day that this podcast drops, and it's our official site that's moving away from our WordPress one, and it's going to be a lot more customized, and it's going to have a lot more content on it. And we're looking at shifting around the way we're doing some things and writing better articles and things like that. So you can go to dicemonkey.net to check out the big blog.
Okay, is that still a WordPress installation?
I've got WordPress pieces on it and stuff, but it'll allow for a lot more custom.
Okay, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Alrighty. Yeah. Well, I think that's it for now. Alright, folks, that's it for the sideshow. It's time for everyone to go inside the big top, for it's time for the main attraction. Alright, I think it's time for us to get started in this main attraction, so let's do it. Bring your eyes to the center ring, where Jack jumping through the deadly fires rings will entertain you.
Oh man, I'm leading off this week?
You're leading off this week.
Oh wow, see, this is what happens if you don't get the script. You're all, you know, you're blindsided, but fortunately I am prepared. I love maps. I think they're a big part of gaming. You know, there's something about having a map to explore, wondering about all those places. I love maps outside of gaming.
I love maps too.
I just, yeah, you know, they're just kind of like a...
That's how I got my master's degree.
there's this sense, you know, in cartography of adventure, of unexplored places, I think, you know, and that really feeds into the hobby. In a lot of ways. I love the old Greyhawk maps, the old Mystara maps, the First Realms map. Bottom line, I love maps, but I suck at drawing maps. I mean, I'm horrible. Mm-hmm. I remember last campaign or campaign before, I was drawing a bunch of trees. You know, it was supposed to be this clearing surrounded by trees and everything, and my players are like, what are the sheep doing there?
It's those aren't sheep, guys.
Those are trees. They're like, no, those are sheep. So now they tease me about my sheep trees. So I do have a point with all this, and that's that while I do suck at mapping, that does mean that I'm always out looking for really handy tools for helping me draw maps. You know, when I need something a little bit fancier, want an actual campaign map. And that's when I came across Hexographer. And it's made by Inkwell Ideas. It is a hex map making software in kind of the old school tradition of overland hex maps. like you would have seen, I'm sure you've seen with a lot of the old D&D settings.
D&D, Gamma World.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, not just limited to D&D by any means. But, you know, just kind of that hex-style exploration map if you want to make your own sandbox or whatever. And since I'm running a sandbox-style campaign running up, you know, basically run around, find what's there, very much exploration-oriented, Hexographer's been just an absolute godsend. It's got a free and a pro version of this hex map making software. And it was incredibly easy to use.
I gave it a whirl.
I'm actually playing around with it right now, and it's pretty cool.
Would you concur? I mean, it's easy even to, you know, instead of just having a big blocky continent, you can kind of shave off so you have a more natural looking landscape. Yeah. Putting in rivers, towns, names is incredibly easy. I'd say it's the best of all the hex mappers that I've tried out there. And there's been a lot of freeware programs, you know, programs that are no longer supported, but it's just been a really great program. And anyone who's looking at doing a sandbox campaign or mapping their world that doesn't want to spend a lot of time, I couldn't give it a higher recommendation.
Yeah, well, I can't give it a higher recommendation just because it is cross-platform. Because we won't lie to you folks, it is Java, which means that for some of you, Java is slow. However, this is not really the case in this application. No. My personal, as a programmer, my personal observation with Java programs is this. If it's written by one guy, it usually runs pretty snappy. If it's written by a team, it's usually slower than dog.
This is written by, as far as I know, one individual, Joe Wetzel, over
right,
there.
Right, exactly. So,
Joe, if you're listening, great work.
I love it. I'm actually going to be using it for my my little small mini campaign that I'm having with my wife, which we'll get into during the next topic section. Actually,
I do have a sample map that I did for my sandbox campaign. If you're one of my players listening, no, you can't look at it, but up over at my site at RPG blog too. But it was the tiles are kind of a Mystara kind of style, so it kind of has a legacy feel to it as well, which I really like.
Yeah, but it was much easier than me trying to whip out something with like, for example, I do actually own, you know, Campaign Cartographer.
As do I.
I hardly ever use it, if ever.
It's tricky to use.
You know, I've tried that. I've tried Auto Realm. Not my cup of tea.
No, I compared this to a map that I did, Fractal Mapper, and stuff that took me, you know, a week of messing around after work, I had done in a night in Hexographer. Yeah. So if that's the kind of map you're looking for, I found it really easy to get in there, get stuff built up quickly without, you know, really getting into the nitty gritty.
So. You know what? You know what? Even if you prefer to use the other mapping tools, here's my recommendation. This would be a great place to start prototyping your feel. Because it's like you can always make a better looking map later, but for a quick and for doing something really quick and prototyping a map, I mean, at least a land, you know, wilderness map, I can't think of anything better to use this for.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, there's a free version, so folks can try it out like Mark is now. The paid version does include the ability to run the program offline. You can customize terrain hexes, add hex notes, which you can even export as HTML, You can expand the map as well. So it's a $7 a year license.
Does have a $25 license too.
Lifetime, and I'd say it'd be worth, you know, either. I think you'd definitely get your money out of it, especially if you've found that other programs are really sapping your time, and you want a cool map, but you don't want to spend, you know, a week on it. So, it'd definitely get the highest recommendation again. So,
excellent.
All right. Well, yeah, I think that just about covers it.
Great.
So, let's go to the next act. The monks of Abu Ghraib will amaze you with their feats of tumbling and acrobatics. And someone maybe not. Yeah, that would be you.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're. I was going to talk today about gaming with significant others. Back when Dice Monkey, my blog, first started, one of the first articles we put up was actually written by my wife, and it was about gaming with yours. Actually, no, the first one was written by me. My wife wrote a sequel to it. But it was gaming with significant others, girlfriends, wives, if you're a woman, boyfriends or husbands. Have either of you ever played with...
Yes.
Yeah? How's that worked
poorly.
Out?
It's interesting because my wife hasn't played a lot. So mm-hmm. It kind of, you know, as a game master, it kind of reminds me of, you know, hey, you have to do things just a little bit differently.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that's an absolute truism there. You know, and luckily, you know, I'm all about having fun when I game, so it's not like anyone in my game is going to feel like I'm punishing them for something. So that whole ball of wax is out the window.
Mm-hmm. My wife had never played any role-playing games before. Didn't really even know what they were about. But then
I'll tell you a funny story after this.
All right. When she moved over to Virginia with me, unpacking all the boxes, I'm pulling out just books upon books upon books, probably at least 100 game books. And she's like, well, where are we going to put all this? So, and she made me put them in the closet to keep them out of the way. But then I finally convinced her to play, and it was difficult to get her into it, but eventually she ended up sitting down and actually really enjoys 4th edition. And now she's, you know, writing for the blog, and she's now become a proficient miniatures painter, and now considers herself a full-blown gamer.
Yeah, let me guess. Your wife paints better than you do. I know that's what happened to me.
She's getting there. She's definitely getting there. And then also I had a girlfriend back probably about 4 or 5 years ago now, and I got her into gaming, and we actually played in a Serenity RPG for a while with another couple, and she also was never a gamer, but I've found that it can be kind of tricky to make sure, like, I don't feel like I play favorites when I'm playing the DM for a significant other, but it's difficult to make sure that your other players don't think you are. Have you ever played with other people along with your wife?
Yeah. I mean, okay. I'm not playing D&D or any fantasy game or any game for that matter, unless, you know, I have a couple of 3 players. I mean, I've canceled pure sessions.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, what I have had happen is that we used to play with some other people that were dating, our married couple, and that kind of destroyed my game because, you know, their issues came out at the game table, which kind of didn't help. So it's it can be very interesting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as a game master, I haven't had a problem with that. I mean,
yeah,
playing with my wife.
Other
people's wives, yes, but.
And with my wife, usually if we're both, like, players, our characters usually don't interact. We don't have... Our characters usually have relationships, like, with other people, so that our characters aren't really spending a ton of time interacting, and people just feel like, you know, we're sort of sitting there doing our own thing. And then when I'm DMing, I make it a point to make sure, you know, the monsters are attacking her just as often as everybody else. Because I know that some people... They automatically assume that you're
helping out.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't even tell her the plot of most of the games that are coming up because I've got another guy in our group who I work with, and he likes listening to, like, me just spouting out ideas. So he's usually the one who knows what's going to be coming up, and not her. So
yeah, well, you know that, and my wife isn't. I do a lot of my stuff while I'm at work, so yeah, mm-hmm. she she doesn't really listen to that. So,
yeah.
So it's really not too bad. I find it actually kind of rewarding, though, myself, because it's kind of interesting to have something that you can do together. You
know? Exactly, yeah.
You know, uh-huh. Don't get me wrong. I'm a firm believer that, you know, people should, in a relationship, each one should have their own hobbies that they can do by themselves, that they're not interrelated. But gaming's a nice one because it's a social activity. You get to meet other people. You know, like I said, we've played with married couples before. We've played with other people in relationships before. And, you know, you do things sometimes as couples that have nothing to do with gaming. So it can be, it can be a good thing.
Yeah, we've got a couple in our gaming group now, too. So it's fun to interact with them, too. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, my wife's not really, she loves board games. She loves card games, but she's not a tabletop gamer. You know, and that's something we've just, I'm sure it's not easy for her. At a lot of, you know, it can be, you know, because there's still stigma with the hobby a lot of times and stuff, you know. So when she explains to some of her relatives, I think there's some eye rolls sometimes. But, you know, she's nice enough to let me game every other weekend, right? You know, and we have 3 kids and a 6-month-old. So I can't be too upset about that, you know.
It all works out in the end.
Yeah, well, we tried it. It's just not her thing. And at some point you agree, and she still listens to me because I, you know, I'm like, okay, so here's what I did. She still listens to my session recaps and stuff. Actual playing, you know, forced to. She has the patience of Job. What can I say?
Yeah, well,
have either of you ever had significant others who didn't like the fact that you played?
No.
I don't think my wife cares for it that much, but she's tolerant, you know.
Yeah.
I won't lie. Outside of my current wife, most of the other women that I dated before didn't get far enough in the relationship for them to find out my dirty little secret.
Yeah. I had an ex-girlfriend who told me that she thought it was immature, and there was nothing good about gaming at all. And I said, well, what about the lawyers and doctors who come into my game store and are playing role-playing games? Are they immature? And she said, yeah. She thought even they were immature.
Yeah, it's a common attitude. It's a common attitude.
Yeah, which will bring me to the... I find it hilarious. I have a weird sense of humor. But a friend of mine that I knew way back when, he said when he first married his wife, he told her that he did gaming. And she was thinking, apparently, card games, poker, whatever. So she comes home one day, and here he is with 3 of his friends sitting on the kitchen floor with miniatures thrown out over the floor because they were fighting this major battle. And she was like, what the hell is this? So, you know, that was her introduction there. And I always thought
it's almost like adultery or something. You know, they walk in. It's not what you think. I was wargaming, I swear. You know, but yeah,
so that was.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I have played in that group. I think Mark may have mentioned briefly I think it's important to when you're GMing for a spouse or something, because I've seen it abused firsthand where. The spouse, you know, it just had everything possibly, you know, for them. And of course, this was their character from their private campaign that they brought over that had, you know, adamantium blades that no one else had. That didn't last long, of course, but,
it's a legendary magic item that hasn't existed and no one has it, but I do.
Actually, yes, that is exactly what it was a legendary magic item, which was supposed to not exist, that she happened to have, that made the rest of us basically fulfilled our function in the game. So,
yeah.
Something to think about, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, you know, if nothing else, it's definitely a test of whether or not, you know, she's just crazy enough or he's just crazy enough to stay with you. I don't want to dismiss the fact that there are female gamers, by no means. Matter of fact, I think the number of female gamers has risen more so in the recent past than probably when I started gaming.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's just continuing to grow.
Take that, you know, Patricia
Gender Pullman. Gender stereotypes.
I was thinking of Patricia Pullman. I think that's her name. You know, but yeah, thank God she is no longer with us.
Betty Pullman, yeah.
Yeah, that was. I'm sorry, I just happened to reread the Pullman report recently. So, alrighty. Well, I think that anything else that we need to cover with gaming with SOs besides, you know, general advice, don't try to hone their time because and don't have them hone your time because your player, other players will feel slighted.
Yes, and if any of our listeners have any good stories about gaming with significant others, but whether they were good stories or stories that went bad, definitely give us a call or send us a message.
Yeah,
let's face it, the bad ones will probably be funnier. So.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, especially if they're like, what the heck? Anyway, so let's get to it. Finally, we have Mintok, the mind manipulator. Fear not, he has already read your mind. Micah of Obsidian Portal, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. Excited to do this interview. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm. We're glad to actually have you on for the show. First off, what actually made you come up with the name of Obsidian Portal? I mean, what is there some sort of significance behind that?
There's really not, and it's. I get asked this a lot, and it's what happens when you let the tech guy name something. You know, when I first started, I didn't have a lot of respect for, you know, people like designers and marketers and these kind of people. And I thought, oh, well, I'm a computer programmer. I can do everything myself. And so my first thought was, well, I'm going to be making a portal website because the idea of a portal was kind of hot at the time. So I was going to make a portal website. And so I just, you know, I had that word stuck in my head. And then I looked around and found some different portal technologies and other portal sites. And, you know, and I remember reading the phrase Obsidian Portal at one time in a book somewhere, and I liked the imagery of it, of this, you know, black gate. And I knew that the fantasy RPG community would be able to understand, you know, the imagery of it. But, you know, the end result is that it's fairly difficult to type. It's kind of difficult to type and spell. And I myself mistype it all the time. So, you know, the
Are you saying you need to buy the mistyped domain names and redirect them?
Yeah, there's unfortunately plenty of different mistypings that I've come up with. So it'd be pretty expensive to get all the different possibilities and redirect them to the right place. So the short answer is, you know, it's the name that I came up with because I thought I was going to build this portal website, and only later came to realize that, you know, portal is kind of a hollow word. And, you know, you just make a website, and you make it whatever you want, and trying to get caught, you know, with too much terminology, trying to get caught in that trap of defining yourself in the standard terms.
Well, with that said, I mean, what actually made you want to start Obsidian Portal? What was your core idea when you first started it?
Well, it has changed quite a bit. The original core idea was to be a repository for all of the content that people create when they play these tabletop RPGs, because when I first started it, what I wanted was, you know, at its core, a place that you could go and quickly find an NPC for your game to just drop in. That, you know, you'll say you're playing the game tonight, you don't have time to make up a monster or an NPC or something like that. I wanted a way that someone could easily find something like that and, you know, just quickly drop it into their game. And I knew it was going to be a difficult problem, and I had seen other attempts at that sort of in the past, but I thought that I could do it better. And the campaign management stuff was a little bit of a sideline. I had added that, you know, and just started working on that, and, you know, before I knew it, the whole, you know, come here to find characters was way in the back of my mind, and the campaign management with the blogs and the wikis and things like that was by far the most compelling feature. And so I, you know, in some sense tabled the, you know, the character database idea and instead just ran with the campaign management system. And, you know, that's what everyone recognizes the site as now. And so and that was, I think, a better idea. It wasn't what I originally intended to do, but it turned out to be a much better idea, and I think it's much more useful.
Well, you mentioned a little bit earlier that you're a programmer by trade.
That's correct.
Okay, so you did a lot of the coding actually for the Obsidian Portal itself, or did you use off-the-shelf components?
Well, I started with off-the-shelf components, and that's, you know, that's where the portal idea came from. I had some technology that was Java, some Java stuff that was a portal making, you know, system
toolkit and, or something.
Kind yeah, of. It was a toolkit or a platform, I guess you would say. And it was very constraining, and I what was frustrating about it was, you know, out of the box it came with a blog and a wiki and groups and things like that. But what was frustrating to me was just how constrained it was in what you could do, what you could change, you know, the way that you could associate things together. And so I just got more and more frustrated with it. And I was trying to get a friend of mine, Ryan, who actually he runs the site with me, I was trying to get him to work with me on it. And he was very hesitant because he didn't know Java. And I kept telling him, you know, oh, it'll be easy enough to learn. And so he wanted to try out this brand new hot technology called Ruby on Rails. And I was very skeptical, but we made a deal. If I would agree to at least try it out, then he would agree to, you know, come onto the project and work on it with me. So, you know, extremely skeptical on my end, I sat down one weekend and started to program a little bit with this new Ruby on Rails thing. And about 6 hours later, I called him and I said, "Yeah, we're going to do this in Ruby on Rails." and you know, we never looked back. And so that's pretty much the off the shelf component that we have now is Ruby on Rails, which is just a very basic platform for making websites.
Yeah, I've never used it myself. I'm more of a PHP guy myself.
So. Yeah, but I mean you'll obviously you probably know what it is.
Yeah.
And so it's much less. It has much fewer built-in off-the-shelf features than, you know, the thing I was using before. But the flexibility that it gives you to make your own stuff quickly is what really drew us to it. And so we were able to, you know, very quickly start building out the main features. And that's, you know, it's been a real big benefit to us because, you know, whereas you might find some other toolkit that has groups or something along those lines, we were able to make something that has campaigns and campaign party members and things like that. And so, and I think, I didn't realize it at the time, but I think the terminology is very important. And, you know, having it say the right things. You know, people.
Not only people, that, making it work the way you think it should work rather than something that somebody else thought of should work.
Exactly.
Like I said, as a software developer myself, I run into that a lot. It's like, but we can do it this way. We can use this piece of software. And you're like, yeah, but I can't change that software. And you want it to do X, and that software doesn't do X.
Yeah, so. and it's never fitting the square hole into the, you know, square peg into the round hole. It's fitting the almost round peg into the round hole. You know, and you're always feeling like, well, with this stuff, I'm close, but it just doesn't fit. And so that's what the whole doing it from scratch gave us the ability to, you know, just do things the way that we thought that they should be done.
Well, and obviously you have a whole bunch. I mean, how many campaigns do you think you got these days? Or people, or let's put users or whatever, however you want to count it.
Well, we don't really give out the number of users. We try.
Well, right. So let's go with campaigns. Roughly about how many campaigns you guys got these days?
We have about 7,000 campaigns now. So I'd have to check the exact number, but it's somewhere around 7,000.
Okay.
And yeah, and so there's at least 7,000 people out there that think that we at least got part of it right.
Right.
So.
Right. So I mean, I guess my question is, why do you think people choose to use Obsidian Portal over something like their own website or something that they throw together? Do you think it's just easeability, or is there something more fundamentally different?
I think it is the ease of doing it. And, you know, again, one of the reasons that I started building it in the first place, or I started adding the campaign management features in the first place, was because I had tried to do it with other tools. I had tried to use a blog and found that, you know, there was still, you know, because, you know, you run your adventures and everything and things happen in chronological order, so I thought that matched well with a blog. And it did, except that there were oftentimes elements that just didn't fit in chronological order. So I thought, well, what about trying a wiki? So I tried to use a wiki. And, you know, I played around with that for a while, and I found that it was better at managing the non-chronological stuff, but at the same time, I still wanted that chronological aspect from a blog. So, you know, I started building the tool that I thought I would use and adding in the features that I thought would be useful to me as a dungeon master. And then you know, took the leap from there to assume that these are things that other, you know, that other people had gone down the same route as me and tried with the blogs and, you know, and the homemade wikis and things like that. And so, you know, I just took that leap of faith, and it turned out I was right, that other people had tried this. And I also became, you know, I became very surprised that other people had not, you know, that many people had just never even considered using, you know, some of these Web 2.0 technologies to manage their D&D campaigns. It just had never occurred to them. And so, and still to this day, we'll read a lot of blog posts and things like that, you know, someone mentioning Obsidian Portal as this brand new thing and this brand new idea of managing your campaign online.
Well, I think some of that, in my opinion, is just the fact that the laptop at, like, even like the gaming table is still a fairly new thing. There's a lot of people that you talk about, you know, with PDFs and all this other stuff, you know, if I can have my reference source, especially as a game master, on one thing at the game table. And there's a lot of people that go like, I don't like that at all.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And I'm a big pencil and paper person. Don't get me wrong. I mean, although personally, my view is that eventually we're going to see more of the laptops at the gaming table, although I hope it never replaces social interaction.
Well, and that's you know, that brings up a good point that a lot of people often ask me, you know, I'll get feature requests related to providing, you know, real-time chat and, you know, other, you know, campaign, you know, virtual tabletop kind of stuff. And the answer is always, that's not what we're about. Obsidian Portal is there to be a resource and sort of a collective memory for the things that happen at the table. I don't play games online, and I've got nothing against it. It's just, you know, I love getting together around the table with my friends and rolling the physical dice and writing with pencils on paper.
Although I did notice that Obsidian Portal has a dice roller.
I caved on that one. A lot of people have been requesting a dice roller, and somebody had written a really nice one in JavaScript, and so I contacted him and asked him, you know, if we could use it, and he said go for it. So yeah, I mean, we did add the dice roller, but I don't use it. I use the you know, physical dice. I love rolling the dice, and you know, and everybody has their favorite tricks. Maybe they blow on it. Maybe they choose a particular one. And I just, I mean, to me, that's part of the game, and so I love that aspect of it.
Purchased my set of game science dice at this last Gen Con.
Yeah.
So although.
And I don't think that will ever go away. I at least I hope it doesn't.
No, I hope so not either. I mean, it to me that the physicality of rolling something, there's just something visceral about it that you don't get if you use an electronic version. Plus, as weird as it sounds, as you and me both know, computer dice rolling isn't completely random.
That's true.
It's pseudo random, as they say. So. But yeah, that's kind of interesting. I never really thought about that, you know. But I guess one of the other interesting limitations I noticed when I looked at your site is that there, I noticed you guys every campaign can have a campaign map, and I noticed that, you know, depending on whether you have a free account or whether you have a pay account, there's a one map limitation on the free accounts, and there's a 10 map, you know, limitation on the pay accounts. Is there a technical reason for that, or is it just for space-wise reasons?
It's space-wise and technical. The mapping feature is actually suggested by one of my players in my game, and I looked into it, and it turned out to be sort of a neat technical problem. So I tackled it more from the perspective of, I wonder if I can do this, not so much from the perspective of, you know, this is something I really, really, really need. But it turned out to be a neat technical problem, and I had a lot of fun playing with it, but the end result is, from a, you know, technical way of looking at it, it's an exponential growth problem by a factor of four. As the map zoom level increases, the amount of storage that you need grows exponentially, and the amount of processing power that we need in order to create the maps actually grows exponentially too. So We implemented it and started playing around with it, and then tweaked with a few of the settings and just watched as the server just you know, screamed for mercy when, you know, when people were uploading these maps. And so we had to separate that out onto a separate server. So we have a whole server set aside that sits there. I mean, it sits idle most of the time, but then when someone uploads a map, then it, you know, turns itself on and starts churning away on it.
Oh, trust me, I understand. Where I work, I have a process that does nothing but number crunching calculations, and we have processes that run for 10 hours just to crunch financial numbers.
Yeah.
And even then, people are going like, can I get it any faster? No. So, yeah, I understand it's a resource. So, basically, once you actually have the maps generated, there's not a significant hit. It's just getting the render levels then, I guess, is what it is.
Yeah, that's true. And then also the amount of storage that it takes is exponential as well. And so then that's why we had to put a cap on it, is to, you know, we don't really expect anyone to cause a major problem and, you know, start uploading hundreds and, you know, thousands of maps. But if somebody decided to do that, they could, you know, I could pick up my credit card bill one day and find that I was quite a bit in the hole. So we put the caps on for that, and it's a really neat feature, and I love playing around with it. And if people have ideas that they think, you know, ways to make it better, because like I said, to me it's more of a toy, and I don't really use it for my game. And so those kind of things, they sort of fade from view for me. And the features that are constantly changing and improving are the ones that I'm using all the time, because I think of, you know, as I'm using it, I think this needs to be better, and so I work on making it better. And so if there are people out there that use the maps a lot and have ideas on how it could be better and what features it needs, I mean, just get a hold of me and tell me, and I'll try to make it, you know, what people want.
Oh, that's very interesting. So do you get a lot of that, a lot of people offering suggestions?
Yeah, we do. And I tell people that the most frustrating ones are the ones where someone, you know, sends me a suggestion and it's really, really good. And it will take a long time. And so, you know, because for Ryan and me, this is a nights and weekends thing. You know, we make a little bit of money off it, but not enough to live on. We hope to someday. You know, we'd love to just work on it 24/7. But
so this, you know, isn't a full-time job.
No. That's my dream. But, you know, we're working our way towards it as best we can. But, you know, so it's a nights and weekends thing. So, you know, in any given, you know, week or month or so, I have very little time to actually sit down and devote to programming on the site, which, you know, as a programmer, I'm sure you know, you need a large block of time in order to really get anything useful done.
Yeah, well, so, it takes, you know what, even maintaining a generally static website or even a blog takes a lot of time. So trust me, I think most people will recognize that that's a big issue.
So what was really frustrating and really irritates me, it doesn't irritate me, it just makes me sad, is when someone will contact me with an idea and it's a really good idea, and I can imagine in my head exactly how it would fit with the site and where it would go and what it would look like, and, you know, and then I just realize that it would take, you know, so much time as to, you know, be virtually impossible to do. And then what happens after that is that every time I look at the site, I see where it should be, and it really frustrates me that I can't do it because I just don't have the time. So, but we do get a lot of feature requests, and you know, what I would say is our killer feature, which is the secret GM only information that's on every page. That was a user suggestion. You know, somebody just threw that out there to me once, and that was one where, you know, when they said it, I thought to myself, how could I never have thought of that? You know, and you know, using the site now, I love that feature. That's my favorite feature.
Yeah, and that's a pay feature, correct?
No, that's the GM only information that's on every.
Never mind, I'm thinking of something. I'm thinking of your other feature, the one where, you know, you can restrict who can see it. That's a pay feature, right?
Yeah, that's a pay feature.
But I mean, actually, going along, obviously you get all these suggestions. I'm assuming that sometimes when you get these suggestions, you have to get some people saying, "I can help you in this regard." What do you do with those people? I mean, can people do that?
We up to this point, we've been pretty, you know, we just haven't known what to do with people that have wanted to help. We do get that a lot, and it's you know, one of my favorite emails to receive. Even though I don't know what to do about it, I get these emails where people offer to help. And so the things that I would tell people to do if they really want to help the site out is to, you know, focus on your campaign and make your campaign as best as you can, because that's really what makes us look good, is, you know, good looking content on the site, you know, awesome looking campaigns. But if somebody really, really wants to help out, and they're, you know, and they're like a web developer, we've had a couple web developers, you know, some PHP people, you know, approach us with, you know, asking what they can do to help out. We're working on we've launched it. It's sort of a side project, and it's called the Lonely Gamer Network. And so I sent an email about it a long time ago, and it's a way that we exchange information with, right now, just one other site, which is the penandpapergames.com. And it's a player matching site, and so we talk to them about, you know, because people have asked us about player matching and how do I find players for my game, and that's something that we've always wanted to offer, but that wasn't really our core expertise. So we talked to the guy that runs Pen and Paper Games, and we figured out a way to exchange data back and forth. And so campaigns on Obsidian Portal that opt in to this service are automatically syndicated to this other site, and you know, when people search for someone to game with on that site, they'll see Obsidian Portal campaigns in there that are looking for players. So, but that was just one aspect of it. And the main, you know, the main core feature from, you know, the Obsidian Portal side is that we have all this campaign data that people have, you know, opted in to share. And so if there are developers that can think of something cool to do with that, you know, definitely send us your ideas, and we'll try to get you hooked up with all the data that we have. You know, think of it like, you know, making a Facebook app or something like that for Obsidian Portal. If you can think of something cool to do with the campaign data, we definitely want to help you out.
So basically, so for future development kind of stuff, you're thinking you want to maybe do a lot more with kind of an app type scenario where people somehow use your data or something?
Well, I mean,
or Ryan, you know, work with it, or maybe provide some sort of functionality that you can hook into your, you know, your service can hook into their service or something like that.
Yeah, Ryan and I are going to continue to improve the site. You know, we talk all the time and make small changes here and there. So, you know, we're definitely going to keep improving the core aspect of the site, but it's very difficult for us to, you know, integrate a third person or a fourth person, or just, you know, people that have a little spare time to give into sort of that, you know, our core development cycle. It would take somebody a lot of work to get
up to speed.
Exactly, to get up to speed. But if they really, you know, if they really like the idea and they want to help out, it's very easy to understand the campaign data feed that we have, you know, and so I could get somebody up to speed on that in, you know, 10 or 15 minutes. And so if people have, you know, if they can see that data and look at it and say, I know a cool way to visualize this, or I know a cool way to use this data, you know, that's something that a lot of people could do. And I would really love to see what people can come up with. Because it's one of those things where, you know, someone else will imagine something way cooler than what I can think of. And I would just love to see what they can come up with.
Yeah. Yeah, you, when you, as some of our listeners will know, or maybe not know, Obsidian Portal won the 2009 any for best website, and in it you mentioned that, you know, you don't create any of the content, it's the user base that does. But with that, you know, I guess the question is obviously Obsidian Portal is a website, but is that do you think that was the best category for you, really? Or
no, I really don't, and I was actually kind of disappointed that I wanted to compete against the Wizards, you know, DDI tools. I don't think we would have won. I mean, they're pretty powerful, and the tools are really good. But I really thought that was the best category for us, and I felt that, you know, I felt that by us being in the best website category. Well, and let me be straight. I'm very proud that we won, and I'm very happy that we won. But I felt that it wasn't really fair to the other competitors, because they just don't have the same, you know, user base that we do, and we could muster a lot of votes, you know, very quickly.
Well, part of it too was the fact that they kind of took they were going to have a blogging category, and then they merged it back into the website category. So
yeah, and I really think there should be a best blog category, and that the idea of best website is in some sense a little bit antiquated, because, you know, which website is better, Google or Wikipedia? They're, you know, they're both websites, but, you know, the internet would suck without either one of them. You know, they serve two very different purposes. And so, you know, to lump every website together that's like, you know, lumping every book together. You know, it's the message, not the medium. And so I think, you know, I agree with everyone who has been saying, you know, there should be a best blog category, because there definitely should be. There are a lot of good blogs out there, and they, you know, they definitely compete with each other on equal footing. So, you know, and I think likewise, I mean, there should be a best blog category, and then maybe a best electronic aid or electronic accessory or something like that, because there's, you know, there's a lot of those out there now.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do the way they, when I asked them about it, you know, this when I on my own blog, I, you know, I said, well, why is it like this? Their rough answer was the fact that when there's not enough stuff in a particular category, the only way they think it's fair for a product that would otherwise be able to be nominated, you know, is to merge the categories so there's enough people in the category. And I guess I take the opposite view. It's like, I understand that. Either that or you just let whoever, how many you have, go for it, you know. So maybe there's only three products in that category, and maybe you don't award a silver that year or something. I don't know. That's me, you know. I don't know. I don't think they're as technical friendly as they think they are. How do I put that without sounding cruel?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. There's you know, a dozen categories for, you know, different, you know, artwork, book, you know, all this other stuff, and then just, you know, websites kind of lumped into one. And I think that's kind of, you know, the web is huge now. To lump all websites in together is really kind of, you know, missing the point.
So, I mean, we've talked about that, but I guess the big question is there any new stuff, features that we can expect maybe from Obsidian Portal in the next, let's say, 6 months?
Well, good. I'm glad you gave a long timeline, because like I said, we have so little time to work on it that things that I know should not take long take way longer than I expect, just because it you know, it takes forever to finally, you know, get the time needed to work on it. But going to Gen Con and winning the Annie has, you know, has really energized me and Ryan. And like I said before, we're really proud of that, and we're really happy about it. So it's really, you know, it's really energized us to, you know, stay up late and work on it when we should be in bed and that kind of stuff. So, and yes, there are some features. One that I'm sure most people have been waiting for a long time, and we wanted to do it for a long time, just, you know, couldn't get around to it, is the ability to upload images. A lot of people have images in their campaigns, but they have to link them from external sites. We don't offer image storage. So they, you know, they use Photo Bucket or Flickr or one of these other things to upload their images, and then they link to them externally through Obsidian Portal.
Right.
But we are adding the ability to upload your own images and store them, you know, in an album, and then link to them from your wiki pages. It's not going to be, you know, super fancy, but it'll allow you to easily get your images and photos and things like that up and into your game. And we're working on making things as simple as possible, so that, you know, you can just do it right there when you're editing, you know, editing your wiki pages or your blog posts or things like that, that you won't have to, you know, go to another page and upload it and then come back. You know, we're trying to make it very easy. And to people that have used WordPress, that's kind of what we're modeling ourselves after, is, you know, make it as easy as WordPress does.
Yeah,
so,
which is very different than, like, Media Wiki that Wikipedia is built on.
yes, Media Wiki is a bit of a pain to use, but we're trying to, you know, we want to make things easy. We want to make it easier for people to, you know, to manage their campaigns. You know, that's what they're there to do. They're not, you know, they're not there to learn how to use a website. So that's what we're trying to do, is just make it easy.
What?
So that's one feature. Another one that once we get the image uploads done, we have an idea kicking around in the back of our head that we haven't fleshed out yet. And so if people have any ideas about it, you know, definitely send me a note. But once the image you know, storage capability is there, we're kicking around the idea of having a shared folder or a shared, you know, image repository where people can, you know, put images up that other people can use in their campaigns. And a lot of these wouldn't necessarily be, you know, very large, you know, full color paintings or photos or anything like that. But the small sort of clip art that you'll notice a lot of the campaigns have, where they'll make a small image that they use as a divider between blog posts, or, you know, they'll use, you know, some kind of special little image as a a way to start a paragraph or something like that. And those small touches, they can make the campaigns look really nice. But a lot of people, myself included, don't know how to make that stuff. I mean, we just don't know how to make it.
We're programmers, me and you. I don't do art very well either.
Yeah, and so, I mean, if you look at my own campaign, my Kensing campaign on Obsidian Portal, it's very, very bare bones, very minimal, just because I don't know how to use Photoshop or any of those things all that well. And so when I'm very jealous of all the other people that do. So, you know, we've got this idea of having a shared media gallery where people can upload images that they have, you know, that they have the rights to. So not uploading, you know, copyrighted stuff that you find somewhere and just decide you want to use. And then sharing that with other people, you know, on the site, and making it easy for people to find, you know, imagery that they can use in their own campaign. Maybe it's organized by genre, so you'd have, like, you know, sci-fi versus fantasy. I don't know. I mean, we're still kicking the idea around. But I think that would really make it, you know, we want to make it easy for people to edit their stuff, but then we also want to make it as easy as possible for people to make it look good as well. Because I love looking at the ones that look really good, and I just wish I could make my own look that good. I just don't want to put any work into it. So if somebody else could do the work for me and then just let me steal their images, that would be great.
And if we could all win the lottery.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to go ahead and this is starting to run a little bit, so we're going to go ahead and I'm going to ask the two questions I like to. I've decided that if the person I'm interviewing is a gamer, I'd like to ask, just because, well, gamers help gamers. That's kind of my rule of thumb. So basically, if you had one piece of advice to give any game master, what would that be?
I would say the piece of advice that I would give is, and I didn't come up with this. I stole it from someone. I can't remember where. Just remember.
That's what we do. That's what game masters do.
It's true. Remember the advice of say yes or roll dice. As in, if the players want to do something and it's outrageous or it's just not realistic or, you know, it just doesn't fit the current situation, but they really want to do it, don't just shut them down. Tell them, you know, if you can't just tell them that they do it and that they can do it, then that they have to, they need to pick up the dice and roll them to see if they can do it. Because, you know, nothing irritates a player more than having just the coolest idea and then being told, well, that's not really realistic. You really can't jump that high. I mean, that's, we don't play the game to simulate reality. At least I don't. Some people do, but I don't. So say yes or say roll the dice.
All right. Well, there's your piece of game mastering advice. And so what I also like to do is flip it over on the other side. If you had one piece of advice to give to players, what would that be?
The best piece of advice to give to a player is get behind the DM screen at least once, you know, and if you're a player and you've never DM'd, it's, you know, and I've heard a lot of people, you know, a lot of different excuses for it. It will totally change your perspective on, you know, what the DM does and how hard it actually is. And so I think every player, you know, and there's no amount of time either. You can't say, well, I've only played it for, you know, two sessions or three sessions, you know, so I don't really know the system well enough. I don't really believe in that very much because it's
kind I don't of a buy that.
Yeah, it's a chicken or the egg thing. If you needed a certain amount of experience to be a DM, we wouldn't have any DMs because somebody had to start at some point.
That would be me. That's how I got started. I bought a copy of the game because I wanted to play, and I became the game master because nobody else wanted to do it.
And if you've got good players and good game masters, they will help you out. You know, they will help you run your game, and you will get such a better understanding of what the DM does, so that when you are a player, you'll understand why the DM does things sometimes that maybe irritate you.
What they'll start finding is that they start cutting the game master a little more slack than they thought they would normally.
Exactly, because it's a very hard job. It's a thankless job. You know, if everything goes well, all of your guys are dead.
Not to mention the fact that, you know, we don't get paid to do it either, so.
Exactly.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's been a pleasure actually having you on and doing this interview. Do you have any closing comments?
Well, I would just say, if people like Obsidian Portal, or if you don't like it, send me an email. Just use the contact form on the site. Those go directly to me, and I love hearing from people with ideas, criticism, comments, everything. I love that stuff. So please, you know, contact me and tell me what you think.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. This has been very, very exciting for me.
Alrighty. All right. Well, yeah. that was an interesting interview. I was glad I was able to do it. I'm sorry you two were not able to join us for that particular one.
Yeah, I was really sad to have missed it, but I had duty that day, so.
I got to meet Micah briefly at Gen Con this year, and
that's how I actually set up the interviews. I met him at the met him at least twice. Well, actually, I met him like three times. I met him at the meetup. I met him at one of the seminars, and I ran into him somewhere else. I forget where. That's how
Gen
I ended
Con's
up.
Weird like that. Yeah, you see the same person like five times over the course of Gen Con, then the people the other people you thought you'd see, you didn't see at all. But yeah, nice guy, and just done a great job with the site.
Yeah. So I actually introduced the guy from Gold to Micah, had them have a little conversation.
Oh, Dave Nett? Yeah, cool. Yeah.
So, which was really weird. It's like, I don't know either one of them very well. It's like, do you know this guy? Sure. There you go.
Look at you being a facilitator and a mover and a shaker. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's just wacky. I don't know where that comes from. So, we're actually lucky. We actually have one audio comment this week.
Yay.
Yeah, I know. Which makes me happy, because last show, I keep wanting to say week. One of these days, we will do weekly. Last show, we didn't have any. But this one, we have one from Alex. I'm going to mispronounce his last name. I believe it's Schroeder.
I believe so.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Alex, if I mispronounce your last name. I suck. But here we go.
Hi, guys. This is Alex from Switzerland. In the last episode, you talked about retro clones and mentioned that some of these games are in fact new games that have been designed to play and feel like these old games. You mentioned Explorers. Another such example that I know about and that I really enjoyed reading was Mazes and Minotaurs. That game starts with the premise, what if the designers of the first role-playing game were in fact inspired by Greek mythology instead of the European elves, dwarves, giants mythology. I really enjoyed reading that, and the funny thing is that it sort of parodies and parallels the development of Dungeons and Dragons in that it has an original edition and an advanced edition, and it has the advanced edition is separated into three books, and there is some unearthed add-ons that you can get, and there is a magazine, a quarterly magazine that comes out with additional ideas and adventures and expansions. It's really great little subculture of old school games designed in modern times. If you have some time, give it a look. Cheers.
Well, that was actually pretty cool. The funny thing is I've completely forgotten about that. I actually ran across that thing a long time ago, and I was thinking, wow, that's really bizarre, but kind of cool.
It sounds really cool, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. It's like, you know, it does make you wonder though, what would have happened if, you know, they weren't into medieval, they were more into the classical stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, we do have classical elements. I mean, you almost can't get away with that in the fantasy realm, so.
I found it really interesting. A couple games have done that. You know, you had the Explorers RPG that kind of, you know, says what if Gygax and Arneson and the founders of the hobby were more into sci-fi than they were fantasy. And it's kind of it's an interesting look. It's a free download, so over at Gray Area Games, you know, if people want to look. But it's kind of that also what if sort of tack. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, well, thank you, Alex, for your comment. That was
well,
fun,
thank you, sir.
I completely forgot about that.
I really love getting these calls from international listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, luckily, most of them, they just record a voice comment and email it to us.
Yeah.
You can do that as well if you'd like to. You can send it to info@rpgcircus.com. If you're in the United States, you can actually call us toll-free at 1-888-643-6322. That, again, is 1-888-643-6322. If you actually have Skype, you can actually call us at RPG Circus as our handle. And if you do that, you will actually get forwarded to the 1-800 number, which you don't have to pay for. Which, by the way, if you are an international listener, you can actually call the Skype username and you can actually get connected to our toll-free number. How cool is that? And finally, you can just send us, of course, regular email, info@rpgcircus.com, or you can Twitter us on Twitter at @rpgcircus. I think that just about covers just about every way to possibly to contact us outside of, you know, smoke signals.
You can try that too, though.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just not good at smoke signals. And one final closing comment for the listeners. If you want to help us defray our costs, we'd be more than happy to accept your donations. If you actually go to the RPG Circus homepage at rpgcircus.com, you can actually click on the donate button and donate us money if you'd like. You don't have to, but if you want to, you can. We're just about ready to, you know, close it up here. Are there any closing comments that we need to make?
Not that I can think of.
All righty.
No, well, hope everyone enjoys their weekend, get some gaming in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, I hope everyone enjoyed, by the time you listen to this, I hope everyone enjoyed their worldwide D&D game day.
Yep, I'm heading over there.
Unfortunately,
even if you play something other than D&D.
Exactly.
Especially if you play something other than... No, I'm kidding.
Oh, when will the edition wars end?
I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying, you know, hey, you know, there's...
That's Jeff@rpgcircus.com.
Yes, yes, yes. No, I'm just saying that, you know, honestly, D&D is great, but there are tons of other games besides D&D.
Yeah, there are some other great games out there.
So, that's all I'm saying.
Check them out.
I don't care what edition of D&D you play. Whatever, toot your own horn, you know. So, all right, well, that wraps it up for this episode. So let's go ahead and stow the tents and get out of here. Edition. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.